Now, by God, it's working. Look at that. Let's see now. Wait a minute. Is it working or not?
You might have something on there that you don't want to read.
That there was a tendency on my part to personalize my campaigning more than... there always was the tendency on the part of those that were associated with me. I've thought back over the years of my political life, and with one or two exceptions, I would say that our organizational structure has not been all that it should be, particularly at the national level. To be sure, when I ran for mayor the second time in 1945, we did have good organization and did carry out an excellent campaign. I think we also can say that in most of the senatorial campaigns that was the case. A great deal of effort was expended by many people. I did help build a political party, so I have demonstrated some capacity for leadership and organization. I run a tight office. I know that I can administer because I've done so as a federal government official, and I have operated an office in Washington that has been respected and known for the quality of prompt service that it gives to its constituents, to my constituents. But when it came to the national level, it seemed that there was something always wanting. I've often wondered if this was not the experience that others had, but I know it has been mine, and it possibly has been my Achilles heel in national politics. It's one thing for a man to be able to campaign personally and effectively at a local level or a state level. For example, when I was campaigning for the office of mayor, I was in every neighborhood of our city. I knew the community. I knew thousands of people by their names. I had been to the lodges, labor unions, to the chambers of commerce, to all of the different groups. It was possible within the time frame of a campaign for a candidate for local office to do just that, as we call it door-to-door campaigning, person-to-person. Now, when you run on the state level, it becomes more complicated, but again, it is possible through an extended period of time to get to most of the communities in your state, to get people to know you as a person, not so much how you are interpreted by the press, but what you are as people perceive you themselves. And this is the important thing as I see it in my public life. When I've been able to get out to have people evaluate me on the basis of their own judgment as they see me, person to person, I have come off fairly well. Needless to say, you don't please everyone. And surely a man's personality is not always acceptable to all the people that he meets. But I do believe the record speaks for itself, that when it comes to person-to-person campaigning, when it came to the campaigns conducted at the municipal level or at the state level, where I was able to meet literally thousands of people personally, I was able to win. Those victories were due not only to myself and my own efforts, but to the kind of organization that we were able to put together, an organization that was related to a smaller jurisdiction, to a community, to a county, or to a state. But when it got to the national level, I for some reason or another, was unable to project the kind of image was required for a winning campaign. It's impossible for a person campaigning in presidential primaries or in the general election for president or vice president to be able to have everybody judge him on the basis of personal contact. You are what people perceive you to be, and what people perceive you to be is what comes through in the media, what comes through in terms of general impressions. And those general impressions are generally the result of how you are interpreted by those who observe you and those who project you through the printed word or through the electronic medium. I gather that my major weakness in politics has been the inability to have the kind of public relations, the kind of press relations that projected a person that gave me a stronger projection, or should I say a more acceptable profile or image to the people. I recall in 1960 being very resentful of the word image. It seemed to me that the image was but a facsimile of what a person really was. The word image does not reveal substance. It's a thinly veiled sketch of what ought to be and what possibly is. Most of my campaigning had been done on a very intimate, direct, person-to-person basis. When I started to rely on the press at home in Minnesota, I knew that I couldn't win. I guess I grew up with the feeling that much of the press would be opposed to me. I'm sure that this is not always true, but that's the way I felt about it. In my early days in campaigning in Minnesota, much of the weekly press surely was opposed to me, and a good deal of the daily press. Therefore, had I depended upon my public acceptance by what the press had to say about me, I would still be jerking sodas in Humphrey's drugstore. It's because of this feeling that I spent so much of my personal effort, so much personal energy getting out to people so they could see me for what I am, making a dozen speeches a day sometimes. Now this, of course, also brought around the press interpretation that I was windy, that I would speak at the drop of a hat, etc. Well, in fact, I did have to speak at the drop of the hat if I was going to get my message to the people. I surely couldn't have depended in the early days of my public life upon a friendly press in Minnesota. It just wasn't there. It surely wasn't in the weekly papers, where over three-fourths of them were strongly Republican and bitterly opposed to me. Therefore, if I was to get any kind of popular acceptance, I had to take my message directly to the people, speaking as often as I could find invitations to accept. And this is exactly what I did. Now, in the process of doing this, of course, I was judged as being a talker, long-winded, and willing to speak at the drop of a hat, as I've said before. I can't help but reflect for a moment, however, that there was another man in public office in Minnesota that was likewise a speaker of talent and was willing to speak any time and any place. His name was Walter Judd. Now, Walter Judd was a competent man and a very persuasive speaker, but for some reason or another, while he gave longer speeches than I did, and as many or more than I did, he was never accused of being either windy or long. Never accused of being long-winded or willing to speak at the drop of a hat. He was portrayed, particularly by the Minneapolis press, as being a man of thought and of conviction and ideals, rather than being one that was windy and willing to talk on any occasion and give long speeches. Yet I believe that the record will show that his speeches were every bit as long as mine, and that he made as many speeches as I did. But the image of Walter Judd was the image of a missionary, of a medical missionary in China who knew what he was talking about and who seldom made any long speeches, despite the fact that anyone that was in his audience knew that his speeches were long and they were good. I happen to think that even my long speeches at times are good. But it's how you're portrayed. It's how you're perceived, not really what you are. And this, I happen to believe, has been my shortcoming in politics. I don't feel that I have been able to get the portrayal of what I am to a large enough number of people to be convincing. This is what I consider to be one of our limitations. Now, in a national campaign, it is absolutely imperative that you are able to stake out certain characteristics that are projected to the public. Maybe I was just too much of a normal American. I obviously did not seem to possess that mystique which the journalism profession likes to concentrate upon. I was known as a hard worker, a decent man, a good legislator, a hard campaigner, one that enjoyed campaigning, a person that was not known for his bitterness. These were supposed to be my good attributes. I was seldom known as a man of scholarship, even though I must say in all candor that I possessed the Phi Beta Kappa Chi, had received the highest honors from my university. Yet I never read in any of the press accounts that I can recall any reaction or any mention of either scholarship or intellectual attainment. Now, why that was the case, I just don't know. But for some reason, my background never came through as a man that was a professor, a student, a person of thought, and one that had at least achieved those symbols of scholarship which so often are mentioned in the biographies or the profiles of other political leaders. I surely was known, though, as an active politician, as one who enjoyed the political battles, and generally described as one who was trying to do too much, was running behind schedule, and had a poor political organization. Now, in all of this, of course, there is some truth, but I think there was a tendency to over-exaggerate it, and to overemphasize it. Later on, as years went by, and I became better acquainted with and on more intimate terms with some of the people in the Kennedy organization, I speak of the Jack Kennedy organization, I found out that so-called vaunted excellent organization was not all that it was cracked up to be. For example, Kenny O'Donnell has reminded me, Kenneth O'Donnell, who was very close to President Kennedy, has said a number of times that their organization in the 1960 period was frequently confused and completely out of joint. Yet for some reason, the press never picked it up. I think the same could have been said about some of the organizational problems that have existed with other candidates, but frequently they were not made a point of political commentary. Nevertheless, in my campaigns, much of the press would concentrate first of all upon what they considered to be mediocre talent that was around me and the lack of good political organization. It's my judgment that much of the talent that we had was superior. In fact, it was good enough to be picked up and asked for by others who later on needed competent personnel. So to boil it down, amongst the weaknesses and limitations that have plagued my political career, none seems to be more evident than the inadequacy of good public relations. Now, PR doesn't come about because you just have somebody that's a competent PR man. It's a complex of many things. I frankly have not been able to understand it or how to achieve it. So I might just as well admit it here at this point in my life rather than to dwell on it. I do know, however, that when you're in a national election, it's not nearly so important what you are as what people think you are. And what people think you are or perceive you to be is how you are projected. Now, those projections, of course, are based upon many things that a person does or does not do, upon observed weaknesses or strengths. They can also be based upon bias or upon some inadvertent development that may take place, something that happens that sticks with you and either gives you a plus or a minus rating. There are so many things in politics that are accidental. Or to put it another way, a man's political life is governed not only by what he does, what he says, and what he is, but the times in which he lives, the events that take place during the time that he seeks public office or in which he engages in public service. Timing and events are possibly more important than anything else. Events can overtake you no matter how good your campaign may be. Things that happen to you individually or personally, or great events that take place in the world and overshadow what you are saying or seeking to do. And then timing is all important. I've said a number of times that what's very important in politics is the momentum that you have. If you can start to generate a positive or forward momentum, and you can time it so that it comes to a crescendo or a climax just at prior to or at election day, you have it made. Momentum is so terribly important because it feeds on itself. Once that you get things moving, you are then sure that you are beginning to harvest a big political crop. I mentioned events and how important they may be. Well, let's take it for example in 1968. The fact that President Johnson was able to announce that there were going to be peace talks at Paris surely was an event that was helpful to me. But then there was another event just two or three days before the election that cost me, according to every analysis, it cost me many votes and possibly defeated me. That event was the refusal of President Chu of South Vietnam to come to the conference table at Paris on the date that had been earlier announced by President Johnson as the beginning of the peace talks. So there you see two events, one that was in plus or that was helpful to me, namely President Johnson being able to announce that there would be peace talks starting in Paris and that those talks would commence the day after the election. Then just the weekend prior to the election, President Chu of South Vietnam announcing that he would not come to the peace talks on the day after the election. Lou Harris, the nationally respected pollster, is of the opinion that President Chu's statement and his obstreperous attitude on that weekend prior to the election may very well have cost me the election for the office of the presidency. No one will ever know, but surely events had a great deal to do with what took place. There are other things that have happened in many an election that where events overwhelmed the political situation. Surely the tragedies of 1968, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, the Tet Offensive in January and February of 1968, that was such a shocking event to the American people. And then the assassination of Robert Kennedy. These were events that had a tremendous impact upon the whole political situation in 68. I'm sure that these put together, plus the disruptions at the Democratic Convention, soured millions of people on the whole matter of the political process and turned people off on the Democrats. Why? Because the Democrats were in power It was President Johnson who was commander-in-chief when the Tet Offensive took place. That offensive by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong was interpreted in America as a major military defeat, even though history now records that it was a defeat for the North Vietnamese, one from which they never recovered. But the immediate perception of what took place in Vietnam was that the North Vietnamese, despite the presence of 500,000 American troops, were able to launch a major offensive and were able to move in on hundreds of villages and towns and had a plan to capture all of the district capitals, etc. Now, the fact that they didn't succeed was not the news. The fact that they were able to pull it off to start it was the news. This caused great disenchantment and unhappiness in America, and a bitterness that was far beyond anything that we'd experienced in the war up to that date. And then with the assassination in April of Martin Luther King and subsequently Bobby Kennedy and the uproar and the turbulence and the violence at the Democratic Convention, all of this had an effect disenchantment upon the Democratic Party and Democratic leadership. In other words, the public couldn't help but say, consciously or subconsciously, that all of these things were happening while Democrats were in power. Now, in some of these things, there was no way that anyone could have exercised any control. You were the subject of events just as if you were out on a lake and a storm came up and you were the victim of the storm, a storm over which you had no control. This is what I mean by events having so much to say about what happens in a campaign, and particularly is this true in a national campaign. And then timing, well, that's been a problem. I've often wondered if my timing has not been, I've often wondered if I haven't been the victim of what you might call bad timing. Not timing that was under my control, but the fact that what I sought to do at the time that I sought to do it just wasn't possible. I want to discuss this somewhere later on. But above all, again, in national politics, you simply have to have organization. And that organization must be able to develop a plan of action. It must be able to include and bring in large numbers of volunteers. It must also have the kind of organizational structure that brings in the professionals or those that are those that carry on year in and year out, and then it must have a financial base. Now, if there's any one weakness in Hubert Humphrey's politics at the national level, it has been the inability or the failure to be able to provide adequate financing on time for the national effort. It does little good to be able to get adequate financing the last 2 weeks of a campaign. You must have financing early, and it must be continuous. There has to be a line of continuity. You have to be able to plan the use of money, and that planning must come early, and the use of money must be in a steady flow with an accelerated amount or an intensified effort coming along as you close in to the final days of the campaign. Surely in 1960, when I sought the nomination, we were totally underfinanced. Or should I say we were up against financing that was far superior to anything that we had. And again in 1968, the Democratic Party was bankrupt and we were poorly financed. Nor did I develop an organization at the financial level that could compete in any way with what the Republicans had. And again in 1972, our problem above all else was inadequate financing. And I have to emphasize that in national politics, to have available an adequate sum of money to conduct your campaign is absolutely essential. There is no hope whatsoever of carrying out any kind of effective campaign without the financing that is required. The national structure must be designed and put together that can provide the financing, or your efforts in most instances will be futile. I saw the Kennedy Organization in 1960 with adequate financing, and I'm confident that this was one of the reasons that John Kennedy was so successful. And only one, but an important one. In 1968, it is well known that Richard Nixon spent 3 to 4 times as much money. His organization was able to raise and spend 3 to 4 times as much as we were able to raise and to spend. More importantly, their money was available early so that they could plan its proper use and not waste it, so that they could buy the time on radio and television early, thereby being able to get the better time slots, so that they could have the money for that was necessary to develop organization and to have field men and all of the campaign materials available early that is so much needed in a campaign. In 1968, our financing was unbelievably inadequate. It was, to put it frankly, a major disaster for us. We were able to get money finally in October, but much of it was on the basis of borrowing, and all too little of it was available in terms of contributions in ready cash. Now, I would like to be able to say it's because the money wasn't available, but I don't think that's the truth. I believe it's because we did not have the people who understood how to raise the funds. I had good people working with me that were very generous and self-sacrificing. But again, the tendency was to rely on far too small a number of contributors or potential contributors. For some reason, many people in political financing do not seem to understand that there's a willingness on the part of the general public to make small contributions, but in large numbers. This is what it takes to win. And this is what it takes to have popular participation in politics. The man or the woman that gives $5, $1, or $10 not only gives money, but gives a commitment. And that commitment is every bit as important from a person that gives $5 as anyone that would give you $500,000. One man, one vote. One woman, one vote. One man with $1 contributed to you is as much a commitment as a person that gives you $100,000. I only wish that more people understood this in politics. And if any good can come out of the lessons of my public life, let it be that popular participation in politics, the use of volunteers, asking people to help, telling people they're needed, seeking people out to make contributions, having the widest possible base for financial support is so terribly important. It's the one way that you demonstrate that politics can be the people's politics. I must say that over the years, there's been far too much emphasis placed upon the big giver. Surely it's easier that way. It's so much easier to find someone who will give you $50,000 or $100,000 than to go on out and find 5,000 people who will give you $10. But in politics, it's one vote for one person, whether that person is rich or poor, whether that person is a college-educated person or a person that's never been to school. Sometimes people in politics begin to think that votes are like money, that if you have a man with $50,000, he has 50,000 votes. He has only one vote, and he may not be able to influence anyone else. Yet the person that has $5 has one vote and may very well be the head of a PTA or something else that can where he or she can influence somebody else. If I had it to live all over again, I would spend my time trying to find people who can do a job of bringing in large numbers of people into the financing of a political campaign.
During my service in the Senate, I came to know the late Senator Joseph McCarthy. McCarthy was elected in 1946 and was a member of the Republican-controlled 80th Congress. The election of 1946, as political history will reveal, produced one of the lowest voter turnouts in the 20th century. As a result of that low vote turnout, and due to other factors such as the aftermath of World War II, the rise in meat prices, the general price inflation, and the disenchantment which apparently came on a worldwide specter, on a worldwide scale, to democracies after World War II. The Republicans were able to achieve a congressional majority. That 80th Congress brought within its confines some of the most conservative and more articulate and reactionary members of Congress in my memory. There were men like Senator Jenner of Indiana. There was Malone of Nevada. There was Dworshak of Idaho. And Welker of either Idaho or Utah. And then there was a senator from Montana. His name has slipped me for a moment. Stiles Bridges of New Hampshire, who, by the way, was more or less the leader of this new group of elected, a new group of senators that came in with the Republican tidal wave of 1946. Of course, there were others that were very different, like Charles Tobey of New Hampshire, a great liberal Republican, and Irving Ives of New York, and Wayne Morris of Oregon, and Vandenberg of Michigan. The composition of the 80th Congress, particularly of the Senate of the 80th Congress, was one that defies any rational explanation. The fear of communism as it had swept over the country following World War II, the Russians having moved into Eastern Europe and dividing Berlin, the intransigence of the Soviet Union in those immediate post-war years, all tended to solidify a spirit of reaction and bitter anti-communism here in the United States. Joe McCarthy came into Congress not on an anti-communist record. He was a gregarious Irish politician in Wisconsin. He had run against, he'd been a mayor of his community, I've forgotten the town, and at one time was a young Democrat. He ran against the late Bob La Follette Jr. Bob La Follette, it is said, failed to get home to his constituents. He was involved with the La Follette-Monroney Congressional Reorganization Act in the year of 1946, and didn't get back to Wisconsin to mend his political fences in time. He was defeated in the Republican primary, and of course McCarthy went on to win in the general election. Wisconsin politics is always very uncertain. There is no party designation, and it was possible for people to cross over from one party to another in a primary as it is today. And there's considerable evidence that a substantial number of Democrats, the conservative Irish Democrat in Wisconsin, moved over to back McCarthy in the primary against Robert La Follette. When I had arrived in Congress after the election of 1948 and the opening of Congress in 1949, McCarthy had already become rather well known, but not on the communist issue, but rather on the housing issue. He was a member of the Committee on Banking and Currency. He was also a member of the Committee on government expenditures, later changed to the Committee on Government Operations. I recall as mayor of Minneapolis going to Washington in 1947 and appearing before a subcommittee on banking and currency, and on that subcommittee were Senators Toby, Ives, and McCarthy. McCarthy was always, at that time, appeared to be a very friendly, gregarious extrovert, hale and hearty, with a typically good Irish smile and Irish wit. It wasn't until the re-election of Harry Truman in 1948 and the opening of the 81st Congress in 1949 that we began to sense that Joseph McCarthy, who was a member of the Permanent Committee on Investigations of the Government, of the Committee on Government Expenditures, on the Committee on Expenditures in the Executive Departments, that McCarthy was going to be was going to follow up, was going to investigate into communist, into alleged communist infiltration in the federal government. Whatever possessed him to do this is I do not know. The first major effort by McCarthy on the communist issue was February 9, 1950, in a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia. And by the way, a most peculiar place for such a speech, where he revealed a an alleged list of communists or communist sympathizers within the State Department and other departments of the federal government. The fact that speech did not receive immediate rebuke and strong protestation from both the government and the general public, I believe, encouraged McCarthy to continue on with this issue. By this time, the Soviet Union had, by this time, the Cold War was in full full bloom. We had already negotiated the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance. We had experienced trouble with the Russians and the Berlin airlift. There had been the expenditures for foreign aid were increasing, and there was every indication that there would be more trouble with the Soviet Union and other communist forces throughout the world. Of course, McCarthy's position was further strengthened by the attack of the North Koreans on South Korea in June of 1950. It was just another example of what the communists would do, and the fact that you could never trust them. No one ever did say that we should trust them, but McCarthy was constantly speaking in terms that would indicate that people were, the people in the federal government, in the Truman administration, would be willing to trust them. Dean Acheson was selected out for McCarthy's scorn and derision. And of course, the entire State Department was the hunting, was his favorite hunting ground. Senator McCarthy undoubtedly was working in close collaboration with a number of right-wing groups in the United States, and indeed with a number of right-wing senators, one of them being, one of them having been elected in 1950 by the name of Richard Nixon. Nixon had made a reputation in the House on the Alger Hiss case, and it's quite obvious that Joe McCarthy felt that he could make a reputation in the Senate by pursuing the same trail and course of action. I must say that McCarthy's alleged expose of communist in the government in that Wheeling, West Virginia speech didn't at the time seem to alarm, didn't at the time seem to alarm hardly anybody. It was considered to be irresponsible. And those of us that were Truman Democrats, of course, resented the nature of the charge because it was, we considered it primarily directed at the Democratic Party and primarily given for the purpose of the elections of 1950. But this opening blast was pursued by McCarthy with a number of other charges until McCarthyism became the prevailing and became the focal point of much of the political debate and controversy both in the Congress and in the media. I became very disturbed over McCarthy and indicated my concern in a number of statements in the Senate as well as in public speeches in other parts of the country. Joel McCarthy looked upon the Americans for Democratic Action as a dangerous subversive force in the country. I was the president of the ADA in 1949-1950, and of course was subject to all of the attack, both direct and indirect, both directly and indirectly, by Joseph McCarthy and his allies. It should be remembered that McCarthy had allies, as I've indicated, a Bill Jenner, a Homer Capehart, a Herman Welker, a Dvorak, a Stiles Bridges. Stiles Bridges was much more clever, however, than the others. He maintained his contacts with other members of the Senate on a much more informal basis than did McCarthy or the others that I have mentioned. Bridges was a ranking Republican member and was, while not a close, intimate friend of Robert Taft, the Republican leader, surely was associated with him in the management of Republican affairs. I guess what I'm saying is that Bridges, while maintaining a strong anti-communist position and indulging in Cold War and anti-communist oratory, was always a little more careful than McCarthy. He never went so far as to get himself way off, never went so far as to get himself beyond the point of no return. He preferred to let McCarthy run with the issue, particularly when it got to the point of demagoguery and irresponsibility. I knew McCarthy and served with him on the committee on expenditures in the executive departments. His main work, however, was on the Permanent Committee on Investigations, of which, and I was not a member of that committee. My work on the overall Senate committee was related to government reorganization, to government activities in the fields of science and medicine and research. But McCarthy and McClellan, and Homer Ferguson, John McClellan of Arkansas, and Homer Ferguson, Senator from Michigan, were the main were the main personalities on the investigations subcommittee. Also, Senator Clyde Huey, H-O-E-Y, of North Carolina, a very distinguished gentleman, a conservative man, but prudent, careful, honorable. At this point, I should check back to see. I should check back the other names of senators in the 81st Congress. For example, one of the senators from Missouri was on the Committee on Labor and Public Welfare. His name slips by me for the moment. We also want to include in that group of senators that came in, I believe, in 1950, Senator Carl Mundt of South Dakota. Senator Mundt also got himself worked around to the Committee on Government on Expenditures in the Executive Departments and was assigned to the Subcommittee on Investigations. These were the professional investigators, so to speak, of the Senate. Now let me visit a while about McCarthy and why he took off as he did. I suppose it's fair to say that he had a flair for headlines. He knew that the communist issue was red hot. The reason, well, we had we'd just come out of a long war. Europe had become divided. The Russians had moved into what Churchill called the Iron Curtain. That Iron Curtain speech started the gave definition to what was to become the Cold War. There was the conference at Yalta and the agreements at Yalta, which the Republicans, so many of them felt were unwise, and of course the McCarthy group accused Roosevelt of having sold the country, having sold America out at Yalta, that he, saying that Roosevelt was sick, didn't know what he was doing, and that the Yalta agreements were not in our best interests. Of course, the only thing that was really wrong with the Yalta agreement was that the Russians didn't keep the agreement. Had the agreements been kept, the so-called Cold War would not have developed, and what is known as the Iron Curtain would not have become a reality. The Yalta agreements did provide for free elections in the Eastern countries, in the Eastern European countries. The Soviets subsequently, by 1948, had denied any such possibility by moving its armed forces, by the presence of its armed forces, the Red Army, in Eastern Europe and across half of Germany. The Potsdam Conference was assailed by the Republicans. What really had happened was that Republicans had been out of power for so long that they had become Of course, the main leader was the leader of the Republican minority in the Senate and in the 80th Congress, the Republican majority. In the 80th Congress, of course, there were men of the quality of Vandenberg, and he continued on in the 81st. There were others of stature. But with the election of 1946, we saw coming into positions of prominence in the Congress in particular, and indeed in governorships, the more strident, conservative leader, the more strident conservative voices in the Republican Party. To put it bluntly and frankly, those who spoke with the greatest degree of irresponsibility and indulged in the largest amount of demagoguery seemed to be rising to the top. No longer was there a constructive dialogue or debate between the two political parties, between President Truman and his opposition. The fact is the opposition became irresponsible, dogmatic, and by the very nature of the tone and substance of their argument, broke into the news and commanded the headlines. This was particularly true of Joseph McCarthy. Joe McCarthy really wasn't a national figure until he pounced onto the communist issue. It's when he pursued the allegations of communists in the State Department, in the Defense Department, and indeed in other areas of the government that he gained national attention. The fact that he did not have full and adequate proof, for his charges seemed to make little difference. It was one volley of charges after another, with no one quite able to catch up to the last charge. Another way of putting it is that he continued his barrage of attack with such acceleration and intensity that those who sought to debate the issue in a constructive and thoughtful manner were literally overwhelmed with demagoguery, rhetoric, bitter rhetoric, and unfounded or charges or half-truths. Constantly, the right wing of the Republican Party, and frequently and at times joined in by conservative Democrats, pounded away at the fact that the Russians would keep had kept no agreements, that they were out for world dominion, that we'd been duped. And the main reason that we had been duped was that there were communist sympathizers or outright communists within the bureaucracy and the executive departments of the federal government. Now, men of the character and quality of Senator Taft were careful not to overindulge in this kind of extravagance. But it must be said that at least in the earlier days of the McCarthy period, that Senator Taft, and indeed Stiles Bridges, condoned what was going on, and sensed that it was a good political ploy to unseat the Democrats and to prepare for Republican victory. McCarthy was the center of press attention, even to the point that when he would disappear for a day, the press would wonder where he was. That in itself would be a headline. I recall on one occasion when he was supposed to have taken a plane out of the National Airport for some point of destination. Apparently, he didn't take the flight that the press had been told he was going to take. And the fact that he did not board the plane was a headline story. His every move, his every innuendo was news. And like many other developments in the political scene, each development fed on itself until McCarthy became not merely a senator or a man, but a movement, and that the movement began to consume not only those that it was originally intended to attack, but it spread itself in all directions. I can recall how Senator Lyndon Johnson, then the majority leader, later on to be the majority leader of the Senate, watched with an eagle eye and with prudent caution the McCarthy developments. Lyndon Johnson always had his working relationships with Stiles Bridges. Both Johnson and Bridges were on the Senate Committee on the Armed Services and on the Preparedness Subcommittee. I have a feeling that Lyndon Johnson was somewhat of a restraining influence on Bridges. And if not that, at least the fact that Bridges could work with Johnson and vice versa kept Stiles Bridges within the realm of political responsibility. I recall the day that McCarthy attacked Bishop Oxnam, O-X-N-A-M, of the Methodist Church for being a communist sympathizer. I saw Lyndon Johnson go to the stand by the Associated Press ticker in the Senate cloakroom in the Senate corridor, in the corridor off the Senate. And as he read the AP story where McCarthy had attacked Bishop Oxnam, he tore it out, he tore it off the teletype, put it into his pocket. I recall him telling me about that incident. He showed me the story, the AP story, and said, "This is the beginning of the end of Joe McCarthy." And I asked him why he felt so. He said, "Do you know that Bishop Oxnam is a Virginian and a friend of Harry Byrd? Joe McCarthy has now attacked a Southern gentleman and attacked a friend of a powerful Southern senator. And just as Willis Robertson always rose to the defense of George Marshall, as General George Marshall, having been a graduate of Virginia Military Institute, so Lyndon Johnson indicated would Harry Byrd, in his own fashion and time, not only rise to the defense of Bishop Oxnam, but more significantly, would lay the groundwork or participate in ending this kind of an attack by Senator McCarthy. While all the details are not vivid in my mind, what I do recall with clarity is that Lyndon Johnson felt and indeed knew that Joe McCarthy had overstepped himself. It was one thing for Joe McCarthy to attack bureaucrats, indeed to attack the State Department personnel. Seldom did any of these souls have strong political sponsors. Besides that, many senators had engaged in attack upon the bureaucracy, the civil servants, the appointees of presidents. This was fair game. These were fair game for congressmen and senators, even when the type of attack was unfair. There seldom was the kind of protest or criticism that would come when someone was to attack a personal friend or a person of distinction outside of the governmental circles. Well, Joseph McCarthy's attack on the Methodist bishop went beyond attack upon a government civil servant. Not only had he attacked a great churchman, but he had touched by his savage attack a friend of a powerful conservative United States senator who was highly respected and wielded tremendous influence in the conservative councils of both the Democratic and Republican Party. The McCarthy attack on Oxnam was but another one in a series of the more irresponsible and vitriolic forays of Joe McCarthy upon people of prominence. It was about this time that members of the Senate started to speak up and challenge Joe McCarthy. I think it should be noted, however, that to challenge Joe McCarthy was to engage in a battle in which there were no holds barred. McCarthy would charge his opponent with every conceivable sin and shortcoming. In other words, he was unmerciful, cunning, his arguments filled with innuendo, arousing suspicion, doubt, and fear. He was very personal in his attacks, but always just skirting some violation of the Senate rule in reference to how one senator addresses another. It became obvious in 1953 and 54 that McCarthy was not only becoming more irresponsible, but that he was drinking, all of which added to his growing irresponsibility. It was about this time that men like William Benton, Senator from Connecticut, Herbert Lehman, Senator from New York, and others began to take up the challenge of Joe McCarthy. It was Bill Benton who really faced the McCarthy lion in his den. It was Bill Benton, as I recall, who offered the motion of censure. Of course, McCarthy counterattacked by wanting to censor, by offering a motion to censor Benton. I recall Benton telling me to be very careful in my attacks on McCarthy, that in order to successfully take on McCarthy, you had to have powerful connections in the press. You had to have a background of years of contact with public opinion, with leaders of public opinion. In other words, this was no job for a novice. Bill Benton knew practically everybody in the publishing world. He was a close friend of Henry Luce of Life magazine and Life and Time magazine. He knew people in the finance and world and in the world of journalism. He had gained a great reputation as a businessman in the early 1930s. He had been a vice president of the University of Chicago, the publisher of Encyclopedia Britannica, an assistant secretary of state, a man of wealth, stature, and held in high esteem in many quarters of the business, social, and political world. Besides, Bill Benton was fearless, and he tore into McCarthy with a ferocity that I think, for the moment, unnerved McCarthy. While McCarthy counterattacked, that counterattack never was very effective, nor did it seem to have any impact on Benton or those that were in support of Benton. To the everlasting credit of Bill Benton, he blew the whistle on not only Joe McCarthy, but McCarthyism. McCarthyism can be defined as a method of irresponsible political attack upon an opponent, indulging in personal invective, half-truths, contesting, challenging one's patriotism, impugning one's motives, and using circumstantial evidence as conclusive proof in a manner to defame a person, to attack his character, and to undermine his cause. The McCarthyism of the 1950s was based upon the assumption and the charge that the highest councils of government were dangerously infiltrated by communists or fellow travelers, that those who were the elected officials in the executive branch were either dupes of these communists and fellow travelers, or so ignorant that they didn't understand who they were, or what they were, or how to deal with them. The election of 1952 saw McCarthyism riding high, even to a point where President Eisenhower was unwilling to challenge the assertions and the extravagances and irresponsible statements of McCarthy and his ilk. Many an American was terribly disappointed when Eisenhower failed to defend the reputation of General George Marshall after General Marshall had been attacked by Jenner and McCarthy. But the fact that Eisenhower was elected started to bring to an end the tide of irresponsibility and demagoguery that was characterizing so much of the leadership, of the articulate and vociferous leadership of the Republican Party. I recall feeling that as much as I wanted Adlai Stevenson to be elected in 1952, that I knew that if the Democrats were in another 4 or 8 years, that the intensity of Republican bitterness and attack would accelerate to a point of danger to the entire system, to our entire political system. At least that's the way that I felt. And looking back over this period, it was maybe a godsend for the Republic that Eisenhower came in. First of all, he was trusted by the rank and file of the American people. He was the father image. He was a man who had demonstrated his love for and dedication to the country. He was considered to be non-political in the sense of a partisan man, even though his administration surely was both political and partisan. And ultimately, Eisenhower had to face up to Joseph McCarthy. It either had to be the Republican Party of Eisenhower and Taft, or the Republican Party of McCarthy and Bridges. And the Eisenhower as president obviously had the power to do something about this if he was willing to do it. To those of us that were so distressed over Joseph McCarthy and his tactics, it seemed as if Eisenhower waited and waited and hesitated when we thought he ought to have moved.
But I gather that as you look back over the over this period, that but that the judgment of Eisenhower and Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, was the sound judgment. Eisenhower waited for Joe McCarthy to indulge in ever more irresponsible accusations. And then he was ready to, and then the president was ready to act. Johnson waited until McCarthy had moved from his, had moved his attack from the State Department and executive officials into the general public, and where he had violated, openly violated, rules of the Senate, and the, and had also violated the traditions as to the conduct of a senator. I often think of the, of a rather strange comparison. Back in the 20s, everyone knew that Al Capone was a mobster and a gangster, and that he had, that he and his gang had been responsible for innumerable crimes, including murder. But what finally tripped Capone was his failure to pay his income taxes. In other words, he violated one of the traditional laws of the country, and ran into the network of federal agents that were assigned to see to it that the income tax laws were obeyed. Joe McCarthy had destroyed literally the lives, Joe McCarthy had literally destroyed the lives of dozens of people. For all practical purposes, he had wrecked the State Department, at least its Far Eastern Bureau. He had terrified bureaucrats to a point where objective reporting and analysis was no longer possible, lest what was reported by a Foreign Service officer and would come back to haunt him later on. But Joe McCarthy made the fatal mistake of attacking senators and violating the rules of the Senate. Also, he compounded this mistake by attacking respected personal friends of powerful senators, in the instance of Bishop Oxnam and Harry Byrd. It was on these grounds that Lyndon Johnson moved, and after consultation with Republican leadership, to establish a committee to look into the conduct of Joseph McCarthy. It should be remembered that the motion of Lyndon Johnson was not to censor Joe McCarthy, but rather to set up a committee of trusted, respected United States senators to investigate into the conduct of Joseph McCarthy as it related to his responsibilities as a senator. It was that committee, I believe, of six. By the way, here we should get the names of those who were on that committee and get a copy of that resolution, and track down a little of, and trace down a little of this background. It was that committee which brought back a resolution of censure of Joe McCarthy, a resolution that did not condemn McCarthy for what he had done to the State Department or what he had done to individuals in the government, but rather what he had done to the Senate, to demean that body, to violate its rules, to to downgrade or to degrade its traditions. That particular report is one of the great documents of the Senate. And from that day on, the McCarthy movement was on its way out, and Joe McCarthy was through as a political power. He was a broken man, but he had broken his lance not on the walls of the government bureaucracy, but upon the fortress of the Senate. I recall that the Bill Benton resolution was voted on, and there were only about 7 or 8 of us that voted for it. Now, I should check this out more carefully. But there was an initial vote on censoring McCarthy, and only a few of us voted for it. I was one of them. Again, many of the liberal publications felt that Johnson was vacillating and temporizing when he should have been taking on McCarthy head on. But Lyndon Johnson knew that to challenge McCarthy merely because he had wrecked the lives of some government servants and had attacked and demeaned and weakened the State Department was not enough to bring about a clear-cut censure of McCarthy as a senator. Even the principle of separation of powers was a protective cloak for McCarthy in such a set of circumstances. But for McCarthy to conduct himself in such a manner as to demean the Senate, as to violate its traditions, as to violate its rules, that was something that the Senate could act on and did. For the editor, there was a request that I give more information on growing up in South Dakota. And I'll try to fill this in. There is a piece in Reader's Digest that I did about my father, which I think would be very helpful background. And much of that ought to be included in this book, pretty much as I dictated it then. At least that tells something about the relationships with my father. But let me visit about South Dakota. My earliest recollections about politics in South Dakota were seeing the posters and the signs for the election of 1924. I recall that there were names like General Wood and Governor Loudon, L-O-W-D-E-N, of Illinois, and of course Calvin Coolidge. The Democratic candidate was John W. Davis. My earliest memories of politics, of course, include that my father was a Democrat. There was always political talk in our home. I can recall the day or so after the election of 1924. I came running up into the drugstore one evening after it had been announced that Mr. Coolidge had been elected president, to make some sort of derogatory remark about Coolidge and the Republicans. I was a 13-year-old boy reared in a household that was presided over by a father who was a card-carrying Democrat.
And I obviously had all of the partisanship of my father. I have not said much about mother in this instance, because actually she was not deeply interested in politics. And my recollection is that mother was not too fond of Democrats. She came from a Republican family. And while my dad was a good Democrat, and undoubtedly mother went along with him most of the time, I have a boyhood memory of mother feeling that Democrats were not the most responsible type of citizens. That's about the way it was. However, on the occasion that I was referring to, following the election of 1924, I came busting into my father's drugstore, making some sarcastic or nasty little remark about Coolidge and the Republicans. In the store was a lady who was known as Mrs. Woods. She was one of the respected women of our little community and was a Republican. My father, hearing my remarks, called me up short and said something like this to me: "Young man, the election is over. Mr. Coolidge has been elected president, and I want you to respect the President of the United States." That was his attitude, and while those might not be the exact words, that incident has lived in my memory ever since. It was simply the enthusiasm and partisanship of a young man, of a young boy, exploding into the political atmosphere of the time, only to have the father remind that young man that the presidency was a great office, it deserved respect, and that when a man won an election, he likewise deserved respect. That was that period of time in the 1923-24 period was the first time that I really had any great recollection of politics. I do recall my father speaking of Woodrow Wilson, and I recall some of the newspapers that came to our home: the Christian Science Monitor, the New York Herald Tribune, and from time to time the New York Times. My father had all of the Wilson, all of the Christian Science Monitor articles on Woodrow Wilson and the Versailles Peace Treaty and the League of Nations bound into a book, which he presented to the Doland High School Library. My dad was a great believer in the League of Nations and a strong supporter of Woodrow Wilson. In fact, as a young man, my brother and I joined together on one or two Christmas occasions to buy my father some books about Woodrow Wilson. The biographies on Wilson by Wilson's secretary, I believe his name was Page. I want to check that. But I knew that Dad was so much an admirer of Wilson that anything that we could bring to his attention about President Wilson would be looked upon as a very precious gift. The mid-1920s saw South Dakota and the Midwest visited
with all of the financial pain and agony that gripped the rest of the nation in the late 1920s and early 1930s. I can recall my father telling me how the Federal Reserve Board had acted to tighten up credit in 1921-22. I believe those were the years. And as the Federal Reserve Board required greater reserves for the local banks and tightened the credit, farmers and businessmen in the Midwest had to pay up their loans or were not permitted to refinance the loans they had. And there was a general liquidation of assets, causing a small recession in that part of the country. It was commonplace talk in the South Dakota that I knew in the 1920s that the Federal Reserve System and the big banks of the East were the enemies of the farmer and the small businessmen. That the Eastern banks, or as it was called then, Wall Street, milked the Midwest of its capital. That it manipulated the credit structure, all to the disadvantage of the farmer, the worker, and the small businessman, small independent businessman. The investigations of the 1930s demonstrated that this folk knowledge, this parochial attitude to which I've referred, had considerable substance. But at the time that of the 20s, but in the days of the 20s, of the 1920s, with the exception of a few rock-ribbed Republicans, most of the people in the Dakotas were of the opinion that the economic system was stacked against them, that the power of big money and the railroads and the utilities, and particularly the banks, was arrayed against the farm producer, the working families, and the independent businessman. So I grew up in that atmosphere. In the 1920s, by 1926 and 27, many of the banks in South Dakota had to close their doors. Farm prices had gone down. But more importantly, the credit structure was being manipulated by the Federal Reserve System and the large commercial banks to the disadvantage of the small banker. Many of these banks closed, these smaller banks had to close their doors, not because they were poorly managed, but simply because they could not meet the demands of the larger banks who were calling in the loans. And the loans at the moment could not be paid. So here was a paradox. The Dakotas were strongly Republican, and the Republican leadership was strongly in support of the banks, and the banks strongly in support of the Republicans. Yet the people continued to vote Republican, but there was a different kind of Republicanism coming to the forefront, which finally manifested itself in Minnesota in the Farmer Labor Party, which, by the way, was an offspring of the Republican Party, of the Nonpartisan League in North and South Dakota, which was an offspring of Republicanism. And and in Wisconsin of the Progressive Party under the La Follettes, which likewise was an offspring or a splinter movement from the Republican Party. Bull Moose Republicanism of the Teddy Roosevelt variety persisted in the Midwest, and many a man or woman who called themselves Republicans were actually Bull Moose Republicans. I remember the first senator that I ever heard of was Peter Norbeck, South Dakota Republican senator. Peter Norbeck was later on labeled by one of the Eastern senators as, I think it was Senator Moses of New Hampshire, who called Peter Norbeck and others like him, La Follette and so forth, sons of wild jackasses. These were the men who spoke for agrarian, for the agricultural elements, agricultural sections. These were the agrarian Republicans. They were joined by Charles McNary, for example, from Oregon, Borrow from Idaho, and Hiram Johnson from California, and George Norris from Nebraska. And it was out in this Midwestern area that was so solidly Republican and socially conservative that some of the indigenous American radical and liberal movements were spawned. None of these movements came out of the Democratic Party. Some of them were absorbed by the Democratic Party. All of them, with few exceptions, were offsprings from the Republican Party. Republicanism to be a Republican was to be socially acceptable. Republicanism was synonymous with respectability. Most everybody thought of themselves as conservatives and sought to be Republicans, particularly in that part of America which was heavily Protestant. Democrats were Irish, most of them at least, and Irish were Catholic. And therefore the Democrats were often associated as being with the Catholic Church and with the Irish. And the majority of the people in the states of Minnesota and North and South Dakota, for example, and Iowa, were of Protestant faith. Also, they were Northerners. And from the days of Ulysses S. Grant and Lincoln on afterwards, from the days of the Grand Army of the Republic of the Civil War, Republicanism was much more acceptable in many areas than being a Democrat. There was also, strangely enough, a kind of an identity between Republicanism and being decent and religious. I always felt that in South Dakota that if you were a Democrat, you were looked upon as sort of a pagan, at least in many areas of our social structure. The word pagan, I suppose, is too extreme, but at least you were looked upon as less than holy, and surely with plenty of doubts by many of people as to whether you were really a respectable, upstanding, God-fearing citizen. This was the environment of the South Dakota of the 20s. And yet, as I've said, it was a paradox. Republicans in charge of everything, and yet the Republican Party breaking apart at the seams. And it was in the election of 1932, after the debacle of the Hoover period, that men like George Norris and Hiram Johnson and others supported Franklin Roosevelt for the presidency. A man like White, the great editor from Kansas, wrote historically important editorials in behalf of FDR. And FDR swept many of the Midwestern states. Paragraph. My most vivid recollections of South Dakota, of course, started with about 1926, when the banks closed their doors, and both of the banks in Dolan, South Dakota,